UK Wine Show, show number 222. Yealands Estate with Peter Yealands. Kia ora and welcome to this week's UK Wine Show. My name's Chris Scott and I hope the English summer hasn't put you in a bad mood. I spent the last few days up in the Midlands. It's been raining the whole time with my girls. We went up there just to have a bit of a break and visited the National Space Centre in Leicester. Quite good fun, quite enjoyed it. If the rain's got you down, don't worry. I woke up this morning with my six-year-old complaining it was raining in her room. An overflow was missing from a tank in the attic due to the loft conversion, and it decided to overflow and spill water all over my nicely newly painted ceilings. Very annoying. Never mind. It's one of those things that gives me something to do over the weekend if I didn't have enough to do. And I'll be cracking on to that once I've finished this week's show. And this week we're going to be talking with Peter Yealands, owner of the biggest vineyard in Australasia, Yealands, in Marlborough's Arbitrary Valley. We talked to him about using bulldozers to create terroir. As usual, we've got our mystery producer this week, and I'm going to give you a clue now. I'm going to give you a clue before the interview and an answer at the end of the show. See if you can work out who this mystery producer is. We're talking about one of California's cult wines. Traditionally, they make only 500 cases a year and is made from 2 to 3 acres of the company's Oakville vineyards, which is situated on west-facing slopes east of the Napa River. Its rise began in 1992. When a real estate agent, Jean Phillips, who had for years sold grapes to Napa Valley wineries, decided if homemade wine made in a plastic dustbin and took a sample down to Robert Moldavi's winery, where they encouraged her to bottle it, and it soon became a legend. Have a wee think about that. I'll give you another set of clues which should help you out after the news, which is coming up next with Jane.
Thanks, Chris. A new wine course called The Wine Trade in Britain has been launched by Plumpton College in association with the Royal Agricultural College. The full-time, four-month course starts at the end of September 2010 and will introduce students to the UK wine market. It will focus on the principles of marketing, grape growing and winemaking and include the opportunity to study the WSET Advanced Certificate. The college hopes it will attract people wishing to enter the UK wine trade, and particularly those from producers outside the UK seeking to gain a foothold in the market.
Plumpton College is one of the key reasons English viticulture has improved in the last 10 to 20 years. And I hope this move away from winemaking to more the trade side of the business isn't going to take the focus away from that. WSET do a fantastic job already on that side. What's the next story, Jane?
Well, drinks manufacturer Halewood International is targeting females who have outgrown Alcopops with a new range of lower alcohol fruit-flavoured wines. Branded Botany Creek, the wines will be available in white and rosé, both with an ABV of 7.5%. The company is positioning the wines to be consumed with food and hopes to bridge the gap between light wines or RTDs, ready-to-drinks, and traditional higher alcohol wines.
Low-alcohol wines are all the rage at the moment, and good for it too. But fruit-flavoured wines reminds me very much of the coolers we used to drink in the 1980s. I hope not. But this looks like the return of 1980s drink. So now where is that bottle of Malibu to go with my pineapple?
It'll be interesting to find out what the price of these wines are going to be, because the latest data shows the average price for a bottle of traditional wine in the UK has risen to £4.40. That's up 13p compared to a year ago. The Nielsen figures also show all main countries' prices rising, except for New Zealand, which fell from £6.39 a bottle to £6. The decrease reflects the price discounting on New Zealand wines in UK supermarkets, but New Zealand wines still have the highest average price at £1 dearer on average than the next most expensive country, which is France. Discounts should abate next year due to a smaller New Zealand vintage in 2010. That's it from me this week, but don't forget to check out these stories at our website, www.3050.co.uk.
Cheers, Jane. On the surface, that sounds like great news. We Brits, I class myself now, I've been here for 10 years, are spending more on better quality wine. But the reality is that most of this is actually in taxation. Since the 23rd of April 2009, when taxation rose to £1.61 at 15% VAT. The total tax take, if you add VAT and tax, was £1.85. On the 29th of March 2010, just a couple of months ago, the taxation went up and VAT went up to £1.98. That's a 13 pence increase in the bottle of wine between the 23rd of April 2009 and 29th of March 2010. That pretty much covers the rise. So whilst in the last year the bottle of wine has gone up 13p, the tax has gone up 13p. To be honest, this is actually quite good news. Well, depending on your point of view, it shows that producers and, unlikely the supermarkets, but producers are no longer being forced to absorb tax rises. And for years, the government's taken 4p here, 3p there, year after year, and you haven't really seen the price of wine go up. It shows that they've now reached a ceiling where they just simply have to pass the price on, or no one's making any money. In fact, taxation has gone up an incredible amount over the last wee while. Way back in March 2008, when the duty was £1.46 and VAT was £1.75, if you add the VAT to the duty, you'll end up with £1.72 taxation, whereas now it's £1.98, so it's gone up quite a bit. And if you assume that VAT is going up to 20%, the total minimum tax take, that's duty plus the VAT on that tax, is £2.03. So quite a rise. Never mind. Let's crack on with the podcast. Next up, we have our book review. Now, our book review is written by sommelier Vincent Gasnier. He wrote a book called How to Choose Wine. It came out quite a few years ago, but I was desperately looking for a book to do the book review in my Waterstones, and this leaped out. I think I chose it because it was an introduction to wine, but written by a sommelier, so I was hoping for a slightly different take on wine, and I wasn't disappointed, actually. So here's the book review. How to Choose Wine by Vincent Gasnier. Now, the book is an introduction to wine geared not to the complete novice, but certainly to the enthusiastic amateur. It follows the traditional structure of a foreword to the book, talking about the influences of wine, such as climate and soils, reading a label. It also has a good section on the cycle of a vineyard through the course of a year. There are two routes taken by most authors when they're laying out this type of book. Either they go by country, region by region, or they go by style. Vincent has gone down the less commonly used style route. For example, he describes wine as light, crisp whites, juicy aromatic whites, full opulent whites, lively fruity reds, ripe smooth reds, rich dense reds, sparkling wines and dessert. The styles are in the second section and make up 211 of the book's 352 pages. Each style is explained and given quite a diverse range of wines from different places in the world. As with all things like this, some of the wines feel like they're being squeezed a bit into these different styles, and I sometimes think they could have been fitted elsewhere. But this is a problem with generalization, and I think its compromises are acceptable. Each wine is given a brief overview, notes on color, aroma, taste, buying wines, and enjoying them. Well, this is all good. It's perhaps the last section that I found most useful. In there, there's a subsection on wine and food matching, which I enjoyed the most. Given Vincent is a master sommelier, I would have hoped that the book had a larger section rather than 13 pages on wine and food matching. But in those pages, he's effortlessly mapped the styles of wine that he described earlier in the book to a range of foods and explains why some of the foods go well together. These are driven by his 10 golden rules, which, while they're not particularly new, they have some interesting insights. For example, you may know, and I know, that protein cuts through tannins like a hot knife through butter. You may also know that fruit hides tannins. But what I'd never thought about is that if fruit hides tannins, then tannins hide fruits. By masking the tannins using protein, so have the wine with a bit of protein to hide the tannins, you effectively unmask the fruit of the wine. Now, doesn't sound like brain surgery, but to be honest, I'd never thought about the relationship between proteins and fruit. I normally get bogged down with proteins and tannins. And it opens up another layer of interrelationships that I hadn't really thought about, which I think is brilliant. Another thing that caught my attention in the book was that I'd never heard that big-berry grapes with thin skins ripen faster than small, thick-skinned varieties. As such, cool climate grape varieties tend to be big, thin-skinned varieties. Now, this is the first time, again, I'd heard of this. And off the top of my head, I can't really think of a case where it's wrong, although I'm pretty certain it does exist. Thinking about it, certainly the more skins you have means more tannins for red wines, which means more heat and energy to ripen those tannins. But I thought that ripening was a bit more complex than this. It seems strange to me that I haven't come across it before, but I will be looking at this in a bit more detail. And there are quite a few surprises like this in the book. I think the surprise in the book is because many of these Introduction to Wine books are written by wine critics who taste a lot, but they've never made a bottle of wine in their life, and they probably don't interact with wine the same way as a sommelier does. For example, a wine critic may say, "I love this wine." That's great. But Vincent knows that 50% of his customers love it, and the other 50% can't stand it. And to me, that's probably more interesting than one person's personal opinion on a bottle of wine. All in all, I really like this book. It's similar to many books I've read, but with the slight slant that makes it quite an interesting book. In the end, I gave this book 90 out of 100, a good book for a beginner or an enthusiastic amateur. Now, Vincent's a Frenchman living in England, and his book does have quite a English twist to it in terms of the way the book's approached and some of the subject matter. But our mystery producer this week is from America, and here's our second clue to our mystery producer. In 2006, Jean Philippe sold the estate to millionaire sports and property entrepreneur Stan Kroenke and businessman Charles Banks. But now it's exclusively owned by Kroenke, who has embraced the responsibility of ensuring the future quality of the wine, both in the vineyard and the bottle. And he's drawn together a team that includes Andy Erickson, who works as a winemaker on a consulting basis, David Abreu as the vineyard manager, and Nick Gleason's a full-time enologist. The wine has been highly praised by Robert Parker, and with such limited production, it's ensured a high price tag. And if you've ever tasted it, you're pretty lucky. Current prices in the UK, I used Wine Search to have a look at it, range from £1,100 to £5,000 a bottle. Wow, that is an enthusiastic price. But I suppose that's the advantage of creating an iconic wine with very little production. Personally, I haven't tried this mystery wine, but I'd like to one day. If you've got a bottle, give me a yell. You can get hold of me if you've got feedback from the show or any sort of interviews that you thought I might want to do. You can give me a call. My contact details are chris.scott@3050.co.uk, or you can go through the contact us on our website. So if you've got some ideas for an interviews and shows and like that, give me a call. Always interested to see what people have got and want to hear. I've spoken to quite a few people in the last couple of weeks about the show and got some good feedback from people. So hopefully you're enjoying the interviews. In fact, why don't you send me an email now while you're listening to this week's interview? This week we're going to be talking with Peter Yeelands from Yeelands Estate. Peter is the owner of Yeelands, and they are Australasia's largest winery, or that's what he thinks. Australasia is New Zealand, Australia, pretty much the South Pacific, really. So let's have a listen to what Peter has to say about Yeelands Estate. Hi, my name's Chris Scott, and I'm here with Peter Yeelands from Yeelands Estates. How are you, Peter?
I'm fine, thank you.
Excellent. You guys are a pretty big vineyard here. Do you want to just give us an idea of what you are and where you're based and what your business is all about?
Yes, okay. Well, we're all about producing high-quality grapes in a sustainable way. We're in the Awatere Valley, which is just south of the Wairau Valley in Marlborough, New Zealand. Mm-hmm. Sauvignon Blanc is our cornerstone here. Our vineyard is 70% Sauvignon, and we've got a reasonable size vineyard here. It's made up of 8 pastoral farms that I've purchased over the last 8 years, and currently we have just on 1,000 hectares, 2,500 odd acres under vine.
That makes you one of the biggest vineyards, if not the biggest family vineyard.
Yes, we don't get too concerned about the stats, but I do believe it. It's probably the biggest single vineyard in Australasia. It's probably the biggest privately owned vineyard, and probably the biggest family owned vineyard. So, but that's just a fact.
Yeah, the numbers.
Yeah, that's right.
Excellent. How did you start out, though? Have you always been into wine, or where did you...
No, I would categorise myself as a trader and a jack of all trades and master of none. Mm-hmm. And I've been in the grape growing industry since 1998, and in the wine industry for the last 3 years. So previously, I've had a go at various things. Basically, worked for myself all my working life. Generally, contracting to local bodies, and in 1968, I ventured into the marine farming side of things, and my family and I pretty much pioneered that that industry. We were
some mussel beds, and
well, not so much mussel beds. These were mussel rafts in the yep. early days. This is all on the sea surface rather than the seabed.
Yeah.
And
is that the ones you see out in Queen Charlotte Sound sometimes?
Not so much the Queen Charlotte Sound, but in the Pelorus Sound.
Yeah.
The Queen Charlotte Sound is in the Marlborough Sounds is more of the recreational one, and the Pelorus Sound is the commercial sound.
It's just so I know, I always get confused. Queen Charlotte, that's when the ferry goes in, isn't it?
That's correct.
And is Pelorus Sound the next one across?
Yes.
Oh, yeah, I've done sea kayaking through there, and I've seen lots and lots of mussels up there.
That's right, yeah.
Ah, okay.
So, yeah, the family and I, we played a pretty big part in that and made up about 25% of the industry at one time. I spent quite a lot of time with setting up a business servicing that industry, building the mussel floats, the plastic mussel floats, and putting the mussel lines in and managing lines, mm-hmm. and everything associated with it. I slowly phased out of that and went into farming deer, yep. a lot of English deer that were imported from the UK, and built up a what we call a trophy herd, and pioneered embryo transplants in that process.
When you say trophy herd, is it for trophy heads on
yes,
walls?
Yes, for trophy heads on walls.
Oh, okay.
And, yeah, was quite successful at that and managed to get a few world-class trophies. I think the best achievement that I did in that area, we got a 44-point spiker. Those that are in the industry will know what that means. But
is that like 44 points on the... On
yes,
the...
that's for a one-year-old deer to have 44 points on its antlers. So that's pretty incredible. But then I went from the deer farming industry to general farming as well, so yep. And into forestry. So currently we have two farms apart from the vineyard estate, and we have a large tract of exotic and native forest. And I'm a typical Kiwi boy, love my toys, my machinery, and I've always had plenty about bulldozers and excavators, etc., etc. And I did, for 15 years, I had a business where I provided concrete, gravel, and aggregates to the commercial industry.
Yep.
And it was probably part of the reason why I got into growing grapes. I bought a lovely piece of land on the outskirts of Blenheim that needed a lot of work done to it. Mm-hmm. So I put my toys in there and made it into a lovely park-like setting. And in 1998, I planted my first grapes.
So you almost constructed the terroir, so to speak.
Yes, that's right. This bit of property was a bit of an eyesore, and it was a bog, and it needed a lot of work doing to it. So we essentially made it into a lovely wetland and developed the drier ground and planted a vineyard. I think I could describe that vineyard, which I still own, as the jewel in my crown. It's a very, very nice block.
And then... getting more into recent times, starting up Yealands, did you always vision that you would be having a big winery? Because it's a big winery here.
I went on from a block at initial block, then did a 350-hectare block in what we call the North Bank region of the Wairau Valley, mm-hmm. and pretty much carved that out of a riverbed and wasteland. And I sold that on, and I used the profits from that to come out here to Seaview, mm-hmm. and... bought my first farm, and over that period, as I said, bought seven other farms. And when I was on about number five farm, I could see that we were just getting a little bit of ahead of ourselves with regard to supply.
Yeah.
And all of that time, I had pretty much been what we call a spot market grower. So the spot market is supplying grapes to wineries that didn't have enough, couldn't procure enough under contract. So I was in a fairly high-risk, high-reward environment.
Yep.
And that works when there is plenty of demand, but it fails as soon as there's perceived to be a surplus. So when I saw that we were getting a bit of ahead of ourselves with production, I decided to build this winery. Mm-hmm. So that was in, just made the decision in late 2006.
Yep.
And we built it throughout 2007 and built it on time and under budget, which was quite an achievement.
Under budget, yeah.
Those days. Yes, it was. So the whole building process here went like a dream.
Did you manage it yourself, or did you get a team?
No, we had project managers in, a Christchurch firm, and they did a marvellous job. I did all of the earthworks, as you'd guess.
And, I can see you. I can imagine you on a big red tractor.
Oh, yeah. No, it's hard to get me off. I used to work into the night. When you're driving a bulldozer in particular and you've got your hand on the controls, you become attached to the land. You don't want to stop. As I say, I used to go till my wife had come up and chase me back home. And there's a great sense of achievement, contouring land and working the land.
See, a lot of people would just let the, they sort of are more terroir oriented and they'd say, like, that's what the soils are, that's what we're going to do. But you're more into sculpting.
No, don't get me wrong. We didn't do anything that that wasn't necessary. And all essentially all I did was take out the cracks and the creases, if you like. So 90% of this land was gentle rolling country.
Yep.
But at the bottom of the gullies, we had little chasms and guts. And in places, we had little sheer drop-offs and things like that. And all I did was smooth those out so that we could, have reasonable length vine rows and put it into a tidy package.
Yeah, I had a look around earlier, and it is very undulating. You know, if you look at Marlborough, and it's Marlborough Plains anyway, and it's dead flat. Everything's straight, 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 and your place is just up and down and all over the place.
When I started out here, there was no vineyards in Marlborough that were on hills or rolling country.
Yeah.
The development had all been done on flat land.
Yep.
And that development had been done using a laser light to get your straight lines. And of course, lasers don't work on hills. No. The light won't go up and down. So I was fortunate enough to convince Trimble, a high-tech GPS. Yes, they're based in Christchurch now, but they weren't based in New Zealand at all. When I approached them, they were American-based. And I managed to convince them to set up an agency in New Zealand, and I bought their first, what we might call high-tech, super-accurate GPS. So it's accurate over 20-odd kilometres to 10 millimetres, so it's super accurate.
Oh, okay.
There was GPS systems operational in New Zealand, but they were only accurate to a metre, and you can't build a vineyard like that. So it was that enabled me to develop these vineyards out here on the rolling hills, and I was able to do it what you might call in a grand scale. And after 2 or 3 years... we had other people watching what I was doing and decided to follow suit. So the Awatere Valley, which has been the fastest growing viticulture region in New Zealand, really got its hurry up as a result of that GPS. And if it wasn't for the GPS, none of this land would have been developed at all.
Why is that though? I can't understand why GPS is so important. I can see, it nice to get nice straight vineyard rows, but
It's
a string would give you straight.
For example, you can't run a piece of string out here for very far on the windy day, and even wire, it's very hard. Some of our vine rows are 350 metres long, and to say they're super accurate as far as parallel goes. And all of your development, when you've got a GPS, it's actually done from your tractor seat. When you're developing land on the flat, you actually get surveyors to come in and they put a peg in where each of your strainer goes, and then you use a laser to get your straight line. Look, I have to say I did my first vineyard using wire and string, and it wasn't very pretty, and I wouldn't have liked to have carried on doing it like that, but okay. I knew no other way in those days.
You said that you saw in, 2006 that the supply was going to start creeping ahead of demand?
You know, being a spot market supplier, you had a good feel for what was going on.
Yeah.
Because you were constantly dealing at that upper end of the market that described the supply and demand. So I didn't have the comfort of a contract sitting back and knowing each year that it was going to go. So as I say, I had a good feel for it, and I could see that we were all getting a bit carried away. And I've always realised that what goes up comes down, and that nothing is forever. And I just thought that it's time to play safe and safeguard my investment by building a winery. With a winery, we can put the product into something that will keep. And in August of 2008, this winery was finished, all bar the holding tanks inside.
Yep.
But we had the 2008 vintage in this winery, and 3,500 tonne of grapes were harvested that year. And I had a $24 million winery without one customer. So it was quite daunting.
Yeah.
Probably a little bit of madness. But it was far better than having 3,500 tonne of grapes on your vines.
We just left to rot, I suppose.
Yes, that's right. So it was a good move, and one that I've never regretted. But of course, I ended up starting this operation up in the at the start of the recession. So we've had a headwind ever since. We're still in a bit of a recession, hopefully coming out of it. But it's been a pretty interesting journey. It's been a very, very exciting, and we've done, I believe, extremely well. And I think probably far better than a lot of people ever anticipated, and proud of the team that I've got. And you know, wait till this wind drops, and we'll leave a vapor trail.
Speaking of wind, Aotearoa, it's quite windy here, isn't it? You're quite close to the sea.
It's very windy. I believe that this vineyard is probably one of the best located vineyards in the whole of Marlborough. If you're in the Wairoa Valley, probably 80% of places in the Wairoa Valley suffer from frost, early frost or late frost. Mm. Even in the Awatree, a large portion of it is frost-prone. But here at Seaview, where we are, we don't have frost. And I dare say we haven't had one since I've been here, and it's not likely that we will. So I'm pretty lucky, because if we had to have wind machines, frost machines here, it would be an astronomical cost.
Yep.
So we have the advantage. We've got lovely tiwā here. And all of this land that this vineyard's on used to be submerged. Everywhere we dig, we can find shells.
Okay.
Soil has got a lot of, it's very mineralised. There's a lot of magnesium and a lot of sodium. So our wines here, well, the whole of the Awatree, is pretty typical of what we produce.
Awatree wines always seem a bit greener than me, to me, than maybe the Wairoa River or the Wahopai.
Yes, I think everyone has different perceptions. The Awatree, I think it's quite interesting. I've seen some adverts in the paper for wineries wanting to buy Sauvignon this year. There's not a lot of them, of course, but not a lot of ads, that is. But everyone is asking for Awatree fruit. So I think Awatree's getting to be a premium. So I'm pleased with that positioning.
You said you've got no windmills or anything like that for frost protection. Notice there's very little bird netting out here as well. Everywhere else in Marlborough is covered in bird netting at the moment, and the birds must be looking at your place with licking their lips.
Well, they look at this and say, crikey, Dick, where do we land? Because there is very few trees out here. It's quite a big expense. And, of course, birds always love to be able to fly to a tree to get out of danger. So when we first come here, we put bird netting up, and after a couple of seasons, we realised that we didn't really need to. We get a little bit of bird damage, but that might be 1%, and I'm happy to live with that. Yeah. And not only that, we sort of love to see birds around to an extent. Yeah. We have falcons on the property that tend to sort of keep the birds away. A lot of Australian magpies that tend to sort of be quite territorial. But some of the perimeter areas tend to get a bit of bird peck, but on the scale of this, it would be totally uneconomic to put netting on anyway.
Sure, sure. Okay. What about wind? It is quite windy here, and wind is great for keeping frost away, but it's also, during fruit set, can be a bit of a problem with uneven fruit set. Do you find that's an issue?
Uneven fruit set here is normally determined by the colder weather, the southerly in particular.
Yep.
I don't know that the wind is detrimental, as long as it's a nice warm wind on a good day to the fruit set. But we're in the middle of Marlborough, if you like. The southerlies come in. And by the time they get to here, they're starting to peter out. The northerlies come in and... by the time they get here, they're petering out. But notwithstanding that, it is windy, and the vines here, they grow under some pretty hard conditions. But that, to me, is good. It enhances the flavours, and we get nice thick skins. So, you know, it's all positive. And, of course, growing vines on the hill, we get plenty of sunshine hours on them. So I think we're very, very lucky.
You've got slopes going in all sorts of directions because it is quite rolling. Do you find that you get uneven ripeness coming through, or does that just add to the complexity?
Yes, we can get uneven ripeness, but we do try and create our rows to manage that. So we'll try not to have one row going from a northerly face into a southerly face. When I first came here, I probably didn't manage that as well as I could have, but we've learnt since, you know, to look after that. But often what we'll do is we'll handpick the higher, more exposed grapes that come on riper first, and they're the real taste buds. They're just bouncing with energy and flavours. And so we'll handpick those, and then we'll put the machine harvester down the row and take out the gullies. So we just manage it.
And the last thing is, when you look at your website, you really push your environmental credentials. What do you think is probably the best aspects of what you do here? There's lots. I've had a good look around, and I've spoken to your environmental officer, Peter. What's his last name, Peter?
Peter Mann.
Peter Mann, and had a nice chat to him. But what would you say is the key things for you?
Key thing here is looking after the land, and of course not taking out any more than we put in. So, as I said earlier, this land here is very, very salty and full of minerals, and all of our growing is done on the topsoil. So we have to be very conscious of looking after that topsoil. So to that end, we put a lot of mulch on. We get excited when we dig a hole and see 15 worms all coming out. So that. You know, if you've got good land, everything else will come right by itself. So all of our environmental stuff centres around looking after the land.
Excellent. All right then, Peter, I think we'll wrap it up there.
Good.
Thank you very much.
No worries.
I hope you enjoyed that interview. Quite interesting. Terraforming, I suppose, is probably the best way of saying it. Creating a vineyard by bulldozing in the valleys. Mucks around with the terroir, but at least you get the shape and you can create the vineyard the way you want to. Okay, how did you get on with the mystery producer? Did you work it out? It was Screaming Eagle, one of California's original cult wines. Traditionally, only 500 cases were made a year from around 2 to 3 acres at the company's Oakville Vineyard, which is situated in the gentle west-facing slopes east of the Napa River. Prices of over £1,000 a bottle, and this makes top Bordeaux producers seem cheap. But remember, they're only producing 500 cases, not the thousands and thousands and tens of thousands of cases that most Bordeaux producers make, which means that if you're producing very little, you can charge a high price because you don't need much demand to soak it up. And I think that's the difference between, say, a lot of the cult wines in America. They're all very small production runs versus the bigger volumes that come out of Bordeaux. Rightio, almost finished the show this week, and the last thing we're going to do is just give ourselves a quote. And this week's quote comes from Vincent Gasnier's book, The Master Sommelier on Choosing Wine. And he says, "One of my favourite styles is dessert wine, and it's a shame that so many people choose a white wine with their starter, a red with their main, and then go straight to coffee with dessert. They're really missing out, and some of the best wines in the world fall into the dessert category." This is very, very true. And do hoover up some of those dessert wines. Until next week, cheers and good drinking.
The UK Wine Show is a weekly podcast brought to you by 3050, the wine tasting company. The show is produced by Chris Scott and the news is read by Jane Scott. To listen to other shows, visit ukwineshow.co.uk. Thank you for listening.